This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode to remember the Holocaust. Maybe you've noticed that the date of Holocaust Remembrance Day moves around a bit from year to year. That's because it's dictated by the Hebrew calendar, and it falls on the 27th of Nisan and the start of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943. This year, that translated to April 21st, and perhaps you heard or saw references to it on the news this week. For the more than 500,000 Jewish Americans who served in uniform in World War II, the persecution of the Jewish people in Europe provided added motivation to fight. Growing up outside of Boston, Mel Friedman was familiar with Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism from an early age.
My father could understand Yiddish because his mother could speak Yiddish. My father was born in San Francisco, but his mother spoke Yiddish. And for some reason, he could understand an awful lot of Hitler's ravings, which were carried on the radio. And then there was a rogue priest named Father Coughlin who had a program that my dad used to listen to and shake his head and said, I'd like to just have him between my two hands. So we were aware that antisemitism was just rampant throughout Europe, and it was starting to get real bad in the United States because the German Bund was created in New Jersey. There were German Nazis that were parading with flags and, you know, swastikas and so forth. And there were a number of other places that they came to light where Nazi sympathizers. Yeah, we were aware pretty much. My dad, my brother, who was 5 years older than me, we were pretty much aware of what was happening in the world and particularly to Jewish people.
You ended up in the Army at age 17?
Went to Fort McClellan, Anniston, Alabama for basic training, and then turned 18 while I was there, and was offered the opportunity to go to OCS, but I was 18 years old. I mean, it seemed a little difficult for me when I looked around, saw some of the officers that had been training us were older and much more mature. And they also offered me an opportunity to go to college. So I said, I'll go to college. So they sent us to Manhattan College in New York we were there for 3 months, and then regimental combat team training. They needed foot soldiers in Europe, so back to the infantry.
When you think back on what your mindset might have been back then, did you feel some anticipation of going and doing something? Did you feel some anxiety that you were hoping you wouldn't get too close to the action? What do you think your mindset was as a teenager in the Army?
It's an awful tough thing to say that you might be brave. You don't really ever know that you're brave. You only prove that you can be brave or that you are brave. But I knew one thing. I wanted to kill Germans if I possibly could. I hated them with deep passion. One, because they interrupted my opportunity to go to college. And two, because of what they represented in the world. They represented evil, and I think almost every kid from my town that went in the service, and we had a lot of fatalities in my town. One family lost 3 boys, and the 4th son survived and married my high school girlfriend. The Lilja family, I think they were Finnish or Swedish or something, but great. What that family had to endure was, I didn't have to endure anything near what they did and what others did. I believe we were the greatest generation. We were called that. When you think about it, I guess the population of the United States was estimated at 130 million at the start of World War II, and our 300 million that we have today couldn't warm up what that generation was able to do, what they produced, food and instruments of war. They were just absolutely remarkable. I mean, how they did it, I don't know. All I know is that I was standing near some kind of a farm in Bavaria. The planes were from horizon to horizon. Our bombers just kept coming. And I remember thinking to myself, where the hell did we get all those planes from? It's unimaginable when you've seen one. You know, how could we have produced all those things? Worst, number one, were the burning tanks at Nuremberg got hit by the SS and the Tigers. It had already taken place, and we were told to grab our rifles and helmets, and but the Germans had already retreated, so we were just looking at burning tanks and the horror of men and tanks. That part of it you don't want to remember. Who wants to remember? You don't want any of your people to hear that somebody remembered arms and legs and so forth. It's nothing that you want to know about. And I think if you talk to young people today, they wouldn't want to know about it either.
I'm certainly not one for graphic, grisly detail. But on the flip side of that, so many of us can easily go through our life in this country today and not realize how great the price that's been paid for our freedom is, and that people just like us. And was that what you experienced when you looked out at that, that you said, hey, that could have been me over there? That could have been my brother, my buddy?
Of course. Of course, you know, you didn't type a single name that you didn't think it could be you. You could hear German artillery and mortars with which they were so wonderfully accurate. But what the hell, they measured every inch that we were traversing, so they knew pretty much where you might dig in or where you might have your tanks located. So they, I don't know where they got all the ammunition, but boy, they sure had tons of it. And this is near the end of the war. And they still had anti-aircraft ammunition, which just, you know, you could hear it going bum, boom, bum, boom, bum, boom. The sound of an 88, you'll never forget. Their mortars were even worse. Screaming memes. Germans didn't mine a lot of things, you know, as we were moving across, particularly across Germany. I don't think they wanted to mine their own country. I think they had the mines. We were going through a wooded area, and we found these stone buildings. They weren't very large, about the size of a one-car garage, and with wooden roofs, by the way. And they were all filled with wooden bullets, boxes of wooden bullets. One of our officers at that time said that was against the Geneva Convention, you know, that you could not use wooden bullets, because wooden bullets were just horrifying to even think about. It was, I guess, equivalent to using gas again. Yeah. We were told that if you got hit by a wooden bullet, it just splintered. And there was no way they were ever going to remove all the splinters. But we found two of those buildings that were just stacked with these wooden bullets. Whether they ever used them, I don't know, but I never saw it.
There have been accounts of the Germans using wooden bullets and accounts of Americans having a tough time recovering from wounds produced by such bullets. So that, I guess, was a disturbing discovery for you guys. But there was something even worse than that, something the whole world began to slowly learn about in April of 1945, just how brutal the Nazi regime had been. How was it, Mel, that you ended up coming face-to-face with the haunting evidence of evil? How did you end up witnessing a recently liberated concentration camp?
I guess I was the lowest-ranked guy in the headquarters company, so I was given a map and instructed to drive Father Kennedy, who was a rotund priest, and as it turned out, he came from Boston. So, and he was just a wonderful man. And I had to drive him to this place called a concentration camp.
Did you know that's where you were going, or you didn't realize it till you got there?
We guessed, you know. We guessed that was someone from either division or army had said that inspection teams had to be sent. I guess so many clergymen, my guess is they just, you know, when they sit at desks and they can ponder, they come up with some awfully creative ideas about who should see these things and why they should see them. I don't think they visualize me seeing it. I think they visualize the priest seeing it. So,
what did you find when you got there? What did you see?
My guess, a football-sized pit. How deep, I don't know.
The size of a football field.
Yeah, the size of a football field. Sideline to sideline and end line to end line. Not goalpost line, end line to end line. I thought it looked like it was even bigger than a football field, but I read later that it was football field size, so I'm using that as a description. But It was just hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of bodies. Most of them just skin and bones, you know, but just randomly thrown into this pit. And I believe that most of them had been machine gunned or shot and fell in. And some were probably picked up by others who were going to be shot and thrown in. It had been covered with lime. Someone had ordered lime to be thrown over this pit. But you can't imagine the ovens. We saw, you know, human remains in the ovens and so forth. But that was a couple of other drivers and I walked around while the officers and so forth were... You didn't rub elbows with the officers, if you know what I meant. They were the ones standing around this huge pit, and we saw it and then kind of like moved away, and we went to see the... We didn't know they were there. We saw the ovens, the crematory ovens. We saw the gas. They gassed a lot of people. We saw those rooms. A paratrooper told us that that's where they had gassed thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Another paratrooper was the one who told us you got to see the ovens. And they only had, you know, like, as far as I can remember, like three big ovens. That's all I remember were three big ovens. They were all stone, by the way. They weren't brick or anything. They were stone. And we saw the ovens. And then the people who were standing around, leaning against the buildings and so forth, were just skeleton, you know. I mean, or skeletal.
Alive but emaciated.
Oh, I don't. Emaciated is too simplistic. Oh, they were... Well, I think you saw what happened to some of our troops that were released from German prison camps, who 150, 60-pound guys were down to 80 pounds, you know. Well, can you imagine what these poor people were? They were just there being prepared to get killed. They stripped them of everything, their hair, their teeth, you know.
What did that do to you, especially being of Jewish heritage, to see what had happened?
I didn't think in terms of Jewish. I could not conceive, as a kid, and a fairly intelligent kid. I wasn't a dummy. I was naive, but I wasn't dumb. I couldn't conceive of anybody being that cruel to anybody else. There has to be some of our generation left that were Italians, that were Greeks, that were Czechs or Slovaks of some kind, Polish, because the Germans exterminated an awful lot of people besides Jews. I don't think the Germans took Russian prisoners. That's at least what I heard. So how can you not hate Germany for what they did to so many people? Yes, 6 million Jews was a huge percentage of the Jews in the world. But I just rode on a motorcycle with two friends, and one of them was an Armenian, and I think the Armenians have lost as many people to prejudice as the Jews might have lost in Europe. Millions of Armenians were slaughtered. Our history books don't tell us these things unless you go to Harvard.
That was a plug for his alma mater, because Mel Friedman did indeed go to Harvard after the war, thanks to the GI Bill. In fact, he played linebacker for the Crimson on the gridiron, which left him with some vivid memories of opponents like Joe Paterno as a player for Brown and Vince Lombardi as a coach for Army, but also of his Harvard teammate Robert F. Kennedy and his brother Jack. Again, that was World War II veteran Mel Friedman. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a man who escaped the Holocaust, came to America, went back to Europe with the U.S. Army, only to learn eventually that many of his family members had died at the hands of the Nazis. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.